Well, it's been a little while since we've done a Sovereign Man podcast. Welcome, I'm Joe Jarvis, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about inequality. Simon and I were on a call the other day, and we were talking about an article, and there was so much material to cover that we decided, let's just go and have a conversation about it and really get to the bottom of this whole inequality debate. Simon?
Joe, it's about time we introduce you to our audience. If you guys haven't heard Joe is part of our team at Sovereign Man. He also is the lead editor over at the Daily Bell. And just a great guy. God, Joe, you and I must have met, must have been several years ago now at one of our summer entrepreneurship camps.
Yeah, about 3 years back.
Yeah, and you've been with us for quite some time now, doing a lot of stuff in the background and writing. But this is the first time really anybody's heard from you. But you're just a delightful guy, incredibly bright, and you're such a great writer. And it was like you said, we're just kind of shooting the shit the other day, talking about something, and I said, oh, we need to record this and have a podcast. So yeah, here we are. Why don't you tell us about the thing that sort of prompted this? You were combing through some news the other day and something that caught your eye.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a school in Great Britain that ended up banning expensive jackets for the students. So the problem they saw was that the kids who couldn't afford these nice $900 jackets, was Montclair, Canada Goose, that those kids were going to feel bad because the rich kids had the nice jackets, you know, coming home from Christmas break with a brand new gift from mom and dad, and they don't want them to feel stigmatized. So, I mean, I saw that and I just thought immediately, like, really, you're not going to allow them to have a nice warm jacket because not everybody could have that same jacket?
Right.
It was just absurd. I don't know.
Right. You know, I mean, the kids of rich people can afford something that the kids of not rich people can't afford. And so we're just going to have to ban that thing because not everybody in the school can afford it.
Right. And actually, it was funny because then the parents are chiming in and one of them saying, well, what about this brand? You know, it's pretty expensive too. And the principal's like, yep, that's banned too. Like, ban all the expensive jackets. I don't know if maybe they just put a price out there and said anything over this price you're not allowed to have. Or
it is truly bizarre though, isn't it? I mean, and it's sort of have a kind of a central regulator that says that a certain, you know, this completely arbitrary price level that we come up with in our sole discretion is the, you know, is the line in the sand, and anything above this is not acceptable because, you know, we feel, and again, in our sole discretion, that not everybody would be able to afford that. Therefore, we think it's unreasonable. And it's one of those things. It's like, okay, so if you're going to ban something because not everybody can achieve it, then what else do you ban because not everybody can achieve it? You know, do you prevent the fast kids, you know, or the athletic kids? They have to give everybody else a head start. You know, the kids that are smarter than everybody else and make good grades, you know, they have to go in, you know, with a 20-point deficit on every exam, you know, and the good looking kids are, you know, the good looking girls aren't allowed to wear makeup anymore. You know, I mean, the people with great hair have to, I mean, like, how far do you take that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Try and make everybody feel like we're all the same and all equal.
Right. I think they tried to do that a little bit with school uniforms. You know, that's another one of these things. But it's not, at least with school uniforms, it's not about the money. That's, you know, I don't know. I guess there's why they really do the school uniform thing. But same thing, you know, make everybody just another number so that there are no differences. But like, are we ever going to get to the point where there's no differences in school? Like, there's going to be nothing to make fun of kids about? I'm pretty sure they're going to find something to make fun of other kids about.
Well, kids are kids, and that's you know, one of the things probably about human nature. But as somebody, I mean, I didn't come from money. I mean, as I kind of explained, like, I never missed a meal growing up, you know, but my parents worked three jobs each trying to knock out the rent, and it was just constant stress in the household. About, you know, paying bills and, you know, some unforeseen expenses and things like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I would have been one of those kids not able to afford the expensive jacket or whatever, or, you know, try to find the, you know, my mom would have probably gone and tried to find some knockoff and, you know, sewn it together with garbage bags or whatever. I mean, you know, just trying to make it work.
I'm surprised they haven't done this with like iPhones yet, you know, with the different technology that kids are bringing to school. Cause that's gotta be, yeah, I mean, right. When I was growing up, I didn't have the latest, you know, video game consoles and stuff like that. I was getting the ones a few years older, and, you know, everybody at school is talking about the latest and greatest Xbox or PS2, 3, 4, whatever. But it's just not a big deal. It's not, you know, it's part of life. It's not something that you can cut down every difference between everyone and make everybody equal. But I guess you see that a lot throughout history where people try, and it usually goes really horribly wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this has been there have been so many instances of this all throughout recorded history. We've seen this literally going back 5,000 years. Anytime there's never been any such thing as equality. Equality is an impossible thing to achieve. You know, I'm never going to be as fast as Usain Bolt, and I'm just going to have to be okay with that. You know, and he's never going to be as good as I am at certain things, and I'm pretty sure he's probably okay with that. And I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about our species is that we, you know, that we are different. We all have the ability to go and choose, you know, make certain decisions in our lives that can impact, you know, our outcomes and our futures. And, you know, as you and I were talking the other day, it's like the one place where pretty much everybody is the same. You know, we're all born differently and we all have different, you know, innate talents and inner drives and ambitions and all these things. But the one place where we really are all equal is in time. And, you know, everybody has 24 hours in a day. It doesn't matter, you know, whether, you know, how you were born and, you know, what advantages or disadvantages you were born with. Everybody's got 24 hours in a day. And, you know, it's how that time is really used. And some people use that time and really, you know, try and leverage that for, you know, maximum return on investment and really try to suck the marrow out of life and get the most out of it. And some people choose to do that with respect to, you know, their, you know, refining and honing their skills and abilities or their core, you know, whatever their physical strength or their speed or their mental fitness or, you know, whatever professional abilities. And some people choose to kind of squander it and do nothing with it. Some people choose leisure and do all sorts of things, but that's the sort of choice that a lot of us have and what we do with our time or our free time or whatever it is. And this is one of those things, again, as you mentioned, has been going, as if you go back thousands of years, we see different examples of this where people, you know, chose, you know, to do certain things. People had different talent and ambition, and people of very high ambition were, you know, used their time to, you know, build things for themselves and created huge wealth disparities. And there have been always wealth disparities, you know, really since even before recorded history. There are people that were, if you go back to the agricultural revolution, people that were better farmers than others. If you go back to, the, you know, the days of Paleolithic ancestors, there were people that were, you know, better hunters or, you know, and so forth. And so there were always, you know, people of greater prosperity. People had more savings, people effectively had more wealth. And what we see, especially throughout history, is that anytime there's a significant gap in wealth, eventually and inevitably, it's always corrected, and usually one of two ways, either through some kind of policy or legislation or forcibly through gunpoint or, you know, torches and pitchforks and so forth. And this has been one of those things that we were talking the other day about this. I mean, you know, I've been, you know, I read a ton of this stuff. And you know, lately I was just reading a book about essentially about the rise of a commercial economy in the Middle Ages. And it was talking about as the feudal system was being thrown off in the late 1200s, early 1300s. There were so many different peasant revolts because that was the way the system at the time, it was really rigged in favor of a tiny elite at the expense of everybody else. And eventually people kind of wake up to that and go, man, this is bullshit. And they grab the torches and pitchforks and they go and forcibly make the change. The French Revolution was, you know, hundreds of years later, a similar instance in which people felt like the system is rigged against them, and they grabbed their torches and pitchforks and they stormed the Bastille and they got in all the weapons and gunpowder and they had themselves a revolution. We see this over and over and over and over again, you know, throughout human history, and it's really nothing new. And I think where the tipping point really begins, where the anger and frustration really starts to rise, is not in the fact that there's a gap in wealth and income. It's the lack of upward mobility that makes people feel despair and hopelessness. Is what makes them feel like, I'm born in this miserable life and there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. My kids are going to live like this. My grandkids are going to live like this. And there's nothing that I'm going to be able to do about this ever. And that's the thing that really makes people despair. And, you know, the hallmark of, let's say, at least the economic systems across Western civilization for certainly the last several decades, if not even for the last couple of centuries, has been that, you know, your ability to make your own way in life. And, you know, this is the quote unquote American dream, where there's so many people, I mean, countless people we've seen throughout history in the United States and to some degree in England or in Western Europe, and even in some places in Asia now, kind of living the American dream, where people, you know, are kind of born into sometimes even abject poverty, you know, or middle class or lower middle class, and they rise. You know, the ascent of man as an individual rising out of poverty and into unimaginable wealth. And you know, there are so many stories of people like that, and yet more countless stories of other people that nobody's ever heard of that were born very poor and rose into the middle class or the upper middle class. And just, you know, to them, that was something that was just, again, totally unimaginable, that they never felt as a child when they didn't have shoes or three meals a day was a massive luxury, that they, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, they would be able to go to sleep every night in a safe, clean house in a nice neighborhood with a fire roaring and food on the table and happy, clean, healthy children. And these sorts of things that nobody would have ever dreamed about. And we're seeing this now, you know, one of these things that's really happened in the developing world to the tune of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, and you know, have been lifted out of, again, abject poverty into the middle class, and that's extraordinary. Yet at the same time, what we're seeing in the West is, you know, really a deterioration of that, an erosion in that basic core principle of the, you know, the rise of the individual, the ascent of the individual. So, you know, if you work hard and, you know, you take some risks and so forth, then, you know, you're going to have a better life. Your children are going to have a better life. And that sort of social contract has been ripped up and thrown away now. And in so many of these places in Western Europe and North America, and I would say even specifically in the United States now, where it's becoming more and more of an economic system for and by and controlled by, you know, a small handful of people at the expense of everybody else. And I think the real travesty is that very few people realize it. They don't understand what's going on behind the scenes. They don't understand that, for example, the entire monetary system is totally rigged against the little guy. It's rigged against the individual and favors a handful of, you know, very, you know, wealthy people and elite at the top. And it sounds like a bizarre conspiracy theory, but it's not really. I mean, if you think about it, when central bankers just create trillions of dollars worth of assets, and that essentially creates trillions of dollars worth of currency, which creates an enormous asset bubble because of this. We see stock prices go up, real estate prices go up, bond prices go up. You know, well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. Who owns all the stocks? Who owns all the property? Who owns all the, you know, all the bonds? Who owns all the financial assets? Well, you know, the handful of people at the top own whatever it is, 95%, 99% of the wealth, and everybody else owns a little, you know, little tiny breadcrumbs of whatever's left over. And so when you have an economic system, when you have a monetary system like that, that basically inflates the value of the assets that are owned by a tiny handful of people, you know, obviously they're going to get even more wealthy and everybody else gets, you know, essentially the raw end of the deal. They have to deal with the inflation and all the other consequences of that. And, you know, that's sort of the thing. It's like people, I think, inherently realize that they're getting screwed. And this has been something you pointed this out, I think, in the article. You know, you go back to, you don't have to go back 5,000 years. You don't have to go back to the ancient Sumerians and the Romans and you know, and in the Middle Ages and so forth. We see so many instances of this. We just, you know, go back 10 years ago to the Occupy movement. And after the global financial crisis kicked off, and you see so many people just going crazy out in the streets because they just feel like, I'm getting screwed by the system. I mean,
It's a little ironic, too, because as you're saying all this, I'm thinking that the Occupy movement, it's the perception of the inequality too. It's not necessarily the truth of the inequality that they're perceiving. There is this massive inequality, but what was done about, you know, the bankers having that kind of control was something like you get Dodd-Frank, and it doesn't actually solve the problem, but it convinces people that's one way to solve this problem of inequality. So, I mean, what do you see? Do you think that these things always end the same? Because sometimes you see the peasant revolt, you know what I mean? If you look at like the Khmer Rouge and Cambodia during that genocide, they were using these symbols as well. They were targeting people with eyeglasses because they perceived the city folk, the smart, intelligent city folk, as the ones oppressing the peasants. So,
it's always about haves and have nots, right? And a lot of times the have and have not, it's about money, people who have money versus people who do not have money. But sometimes it's about something else. And you're right, in the case of the Khmer Rouge, you know, they were targeting essentially the intelligentsia, the educated class. It's about have and have not with respect to education, and say the educated people, you know, are the enemy. And again, these we see a lot of these things very consistently throughout history. It's just kind of dividing people into groups. And I think anytime you divide people into groups and say you are in this group and you are in that group, you are inherently creating conflict. As soon as you divide people into groups, and people a lot of times it's in our nature to form groups. You know, we want to have tribes. We're a fairly tribal species, and so we look for tribes and put ourselves into groups, and you know, that can again be an inherently dangerous thing. We start looking at things through the lens of the groupthink and not through the lens of the individual and the rational mind, and it creates inherently conflict. And again, we do see this over and over again throughout history, and you know, like we're saying, it invariably ends in, you know, either there's some way to, you know, if you look at it in terms of financial haves and have nots, the economic consequences of that, I mean, ultimately, that wealth inequality invariably is redistributed. You know, the wealth is either redistributed through some kind of oppressive tax regime, forcible property confiscation, or again, peasant revolt, legislation, whatever it is, it invariably gets corrected. And, it is kind of interesting because, again, you look at the system itself, and the system is absolutely rigged. And that's really where people start to feel the despair, is they feel like they know that there's something wrong. But, you know, who understands central banking? Almost nobody understands how the mechanics of monetary policy work and how that impacts their lives. I mean, most people would be shocked to realize that, you know, they think the most powerful person in the world is the president or whatever else. No, not by a long shot. It's the people that sit in a room and decide how many trillions of dollars to conjure out of thin air in their sole discretion. You know, that's the stuff that really matters in the world. Those are the most powerful people in the world, because when you were able to dictate interest policy, you're able to set the price or influence the price of everything on the planet: new cars, houses, food, oil, everything. Everything is sort of influenced by the price of money, by interest rates. And so the people that have that ability are essentially able to wield tremendous influence over all the economies, over employment rates and unemployment rates, and all these things that matter so much more in people's daily lives. And, you know, very few people really understand that that's sort of the reason. We go back to the Occupy movement, everybody was blaming capitalism and saying, oh, capitalism is evil. No, capitalism is not evil. Capitalism is, not even really practiced in pure form anywhere in the world, and hasn't for hundreds of years, at least. But the whole concept of creating incentives for people to produce and create value and succeed and so forth, that's not evil. That's great, and it's natural. It's natural. People don't really understand why or how the system is rigged against them. They just feel like they're getting screwed. And I think one of the best examples of that was just going back to the 2016 presidential election. And I always kind of argue, I say that, you know, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, however you feel about them, they were basically saying the same thing. Both Trump and Sanders were saying, you're getting screwed by the system. They both had totally different views on how and why and what to do about it. But the core message was exactly the same. You're getting screwed by the system and I'm going to fix it.
Right. Either the political system or the financial system, but somebody at the top is screwing the little guy.
Yeah, they're preaching to the little guy saying you're getting screwed. And they're right. They're right. You are getting screwed. You know,
do you think it targets almost like the right people? You know, because it almost seems like this lynch mob gets whipped up into a frenzy, and then they're gonna get somebody. They're gonna take somebody's wealth, they're gonna, you know, bring this equality, redistribute it somewhere. How often do you think it actually targets the people that are pulling the strings? Because we're kind of talking about the two.
Oh, never. Things. Yeah, never. Almost never. Yeah, almost never. Because that's the thing is that the actual diagnosis, people, you know, it's always looking at the symptoms, but not the core disease. And the disease is that, you know, the system is rotten. You know, there's something deeply wrong with the financial system. There's something deeply wrong with the monetary system. This whole idea that they say, hey, let's have a bunch of unelected bureaucrats wield complete and total control over nearly everything in the financial system in their sole discretion. You know, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah, sure. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that. And okay, maybe it made sense in 1874, you know, and maybe even made sense in 1913. But does it really make sense in 2018 going into 2019? You know, this is ludicrous. I mean, the technology and the tools and so forth that exist, but there's something seriously wrong with that system. There's something wrong with the education system. I mean, if you look at the education system and say, okay, well, let's take a bunch of, you know, 5-year-old, jam them into a room and teach them how to subordinate themselves to authority, and basically churn them through an education system that teaches them how to, you know, more or less be good taxpayers, doesn't teach them how to, you know, think critically or question authority or, you know, arise as an individual, doesn't actually teach anybody any useful skills about business and finance or any of these things, you know, no, just, you know, how to pay taxes and all these things. I mean, that's really, you know, what the system is. In the political system, where we just keep churning out, you know, the same crooks over and over and over again to go. I mean, it's clearly something wrong with all these different systems. And, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, people come up with an enemy and they say, oh, it's this, it's rich people, it's smart people, it's, you know, it's this party or that party or whatever it is. You know, people come up with an enemy. You know, they create a group and they say this is the enemy, and everybody, again, they're able to kind of whip people into a frenzy over, you know, some particular enemy, and, you know, create some, you know, rather significant conflict and tension and so forth. And that's where, again, a lot of times people start grabbing the pitchforks, or they're able to very easily pass some sort of legislation, you know, against said enemy and so forth. And again, to me, especially from an economic front, if you look throughout history, where you really start to see this boil over is the despair that comes when people start feeling like there's no hope because I'm stuck and I'm not going anywhere. And the data, not only in the US, but in Europe, in Western Europe in particular, we start seeing more and more and more of this, where the data show that if you're born in a certain social strata or economic level, you're going to stay there and remain there for your entire life. You know, some of the data in the United States in particular can be, has been quite astounding. We're seeing a decline in new businesses. We're seeing a significant decline, not only again in the increase in the wealth and income inequality, but the mobility gap is really the thing that's becoming, you know, quite alarming. And there's so much of this data that's out there, and we've talked about this so often in Notes from the Field. And it's just becoming more and more obvious. Again, not just the fact that, you know, see the numbers about the average person has, you know, less than $5,000 to their name, and you know a lot of people have zero savings altogether. But, you know, the fact that, you know, whether it's anecdotal evidence and people just, you know, sentiment and feeling like, you know, surveys that show people feel like they're stuck, but also just looking at the economic data, just the lack of wage growth, for example. I mean, you look at you know, particularly unskilled labor. You know, and the angst that people feel, and we've seen that played out in, you know, in elections as well. I mean, people just feeling sick and tired and fed up, and that they're not getting anywhere in life, et cetera. I mean, there's just so much of that, and that's, again, that sense of desperation is where it really starts to boil. And I find this really interesting because this is all happening at a time where, you know, the economy is quote unquote, you know, in super awesome mode. You've got low unemployment and, you know, corporate earnings have been pretty strong. And, you know, up until recently, the stock market was doing really well. Of course, we've been saying for a long time that the stock market was overheated and overvalued and due for a correction. Now that's actually happened. You know, but, you know, when the, in the quote unquote, everything's awesome economy, you still have this just intense feeling of desperation, and not in small pockets, but huge swaths of desperation where people feel like, I got to do something about this. I'm angry. Ooh, am I angry? You know, and I got to find an outlet and blame somebody. And, you know, this is where you get, again, this just little things like you saw in the UK where they say, oh, rich kids have this and poor kids don't, so therefore we're going to ban it because, you know, we're all about equality and we don't want to make anybody feel bad and so forth. Those are the sorts of things that you see, you know, in times like this. And, right. And I think if you look at the headlines, you see more and more and more of that all the time if you kind of view things with that in mind. And
it's also one of, sorry,
go ahead.
It's especially ironic, though, I think, in this day and age, because you actually do have – more opportunities as an individual. You actually have the opportunity for social movement. I'm thinking even the cheap jackets probably keep kids pretty warm. Like there's actually might not be as much, or if there's as much inequality, it's not as big of a difference. You know, no, everybody in America has access to penicillin. And whereas, you know, in 100 years ago, the president's son, Calvin Coolidge's son, died of a blister while he was in the White House. So it's like there actually is so much more wealth for any individual. But
yeah, you know, I think that's a very astute and mature thing to say, really. I mean, what we're really talking about, these are all rich country problems anyways. You know, I mean, let's be honest, you know, to be poor in Western Europe and you can't afford whatever the Gucci jacket, you know, you can only afford the generic jacket. Well, you know, you still got a jacket. And, you know, let's be honest, there's probably a whole lot of kids in, you know, in very cold places that don't have jackets and, you know, these sorts of things. And but, you know, it's always relative, right? I mean, we can dissect that one all day long. I mean, there's like always somebody worse off.
Right.
You know, and it's not to say that just because of somebody worse off, there's not a reason to, you know, try and achieve more or want more or so forth. But I think it's really just the sense of the, you know, the boiling over and the anger and the resentment about, you know, an individual's station in life and where they're at and the way they, you know, they become so angry about it, the way they want to do something about it is by bringing somebody else down and not lifting themselves up. And, you know, to be fair, like, yeah, okay, it's easy to understand anger when you feel like you're getting screwed by the system. You know, again, you go back to the global financial crisis and all these things. I mean, how many of these big bank CEOs, you know, through the decisions that their organizations made, causing havoc throughout the financial system, the job losses, the losses of homes and houses, all these things, and how many of those guys went to jail for the willful fraud and deceit that was committed? You know, zero.
Right.
None of those guys. And, you know, and people kind of realize that and say, man, you know, if I'd done half the shit that any of these guys are done, I'd be turning big rocks into little rocks, you know, in no time. You know, and you look at, I mean, again, like nobody understands monetary policy, but you look at what central bankers do. I mean, the Federal Reserve in the United States expanded its balance sheet from $850 billion just prior to the GFC to $4.5 trillion. In relatively short order through quantitative easing and so forth. And what does that mean? They're essentially just conjuring money out of thin air. They're just printing money, except then they don't have to use a printing press. They do, hit some buttons on a computer and they do it all electronically, you know, buying bonds through the electronic financial system. And, you know, it's one of those things. Like I was reading in this book, you know, back in the Middle Ages, counterfeit was such a big deal that at a certain point in England, they actually they created a penalty. They said anybody that's caught counterfeiting would have their testicles removed with a hot poker. You know, that's how you
Did
lost a hand and you lost your testicles. That's how serious counterfeiting was, you know, back then. But today we just, you know, we say, oh, yeah, here's a bunch of unelected guys. Let's give you supreme control over the money supply so you can conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air and then loan, you know, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, that loan that money to the commercial banks at 0%, basically just giving them trillions of dollars to recapitalize their balance sheets. I mean, people don't really understand the you know, what that means. But I mean, it's just this extraordinary fraud that has been perpetrated against, you know, against a little guy, but people don't really understand that. So it's easy to get whipped into a frenzy to say, you know, whatever, this is your enemy, this party or these people or this class or this whatever is the enemy. And kind of to your point earlier, you know, it's an easy misdirection from what the real sort of causes of the problem are, not the symptoms, but the real cause of the problem. There's just a lot of misdirection there because people are very easily deluded. You know, people get emotional about things. That's sort of been a consistent theme. I think we've been talking about in Sovereign for most of this year about, you know, when we get emotional, we tend to make very bad decisions. When we're emotional, we're irrational. When we're irrational, we just do, we do terrible and destructive things. You know, and it's a lot easier to do that when people get together and, you know, and you know, you turn on the TV, you know, and it's all, whether it's from the media or from the politics or whatever, it's just kind of whipping people into a frenzy, trying to pick sides, you know, to, and, you know, name enemies and blame enemies. And it basically, and both sides do it, and it essentially creates, you know, almost, you know, some level of warfare there. And we've seen this, again, over and over and over and over and over again throughout history. One of the most dangerous phrases ever is to say this time is different. No, this time is not different. We've seen this movie so many times before, and you know, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty easy to kind of, you know, see, you know, where this, you know, where this ultimately goes. This is not
a trend. It always creates the worst results. You know, the inequality always gets worse after the solution. You know, like even in South Africa right now, we've talked about this a few times, where they passed legislation that says they can take land from white farmers for reparations, for actual inequality of the past. You know, and that's what I think we keep bringing up too, is that the inequality does exist, and there are groups of people controlling things from the top, and then the solution is never applied to those people. It's random white farmers that are going to get their land taken from them in South Africa. It's not the racist from the 70s.
Right. Well, I mean, as again, it's because it's so easy. It's very easy misdirection. So they conjure an enemy. They blame whatever the enemy is. They're able to whip people in a frenzy against that. And it creates this, you know, this obvious conflict. And, you know, because, again, people feel like they're not going anywhere. Their lives are difficult and will always be difficult. And the mobility is basically zero. They have no chance of upward mobility to move to a better station in life, no matter how hard they work or what they do. When people feel that kind of desperation, it's easy for them to go and want to attack an enemy, to band together in hatred and negativity and so forth. And, you know, that certainly doesn't actually fix anything or solve anything, but it is the thing that we see over and over again throughout history. And I think the more you look at this, if you kind of keep that in mind, as you look at the headlines, you read the paper, you just turn on the TV and you see this sort of constant division of haves and have nots, and say, you know, we hate these people, we hate these people, this guy's the enemy, this group is the enemy, this party, this class, et cetera. You start to see that more and more, and it's just you're just sort of like a pawn in this whole thing. You're just an enlisted foot soldier in whatever the conflict is, that's being created. And it is a concern. It's one of these things. Don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting anything's going to happen tomorrow, but this is one of these long-term trends. And I think, you know, a lot of the long-term trends that we talk about is why we talk about things like having a plan B and you know, just being rational and sensible and so forth, because it does make sense. There are a number of very long-term trends afoot. I don't think anybody can predict the future. Anybody that wants to say this is going to happen on this day or by this day, whatever, is, you know, it's just silly. But what we can do is we can look out and see very long-term trends. We can see, well, here's where things are now and here's how things have been going. And we just kind of look at the direction and say, look, this has been happening for years and years and years and years and years. We look at something, we talk about Social Security a lot, you know, and say, look, Social Security is going bankrupt, because we can see the obvious demographic trends. We can see there's 10,000 baby boomers a day that join the ranks of Social Security beneficiaries. And we can see the numbers in the system and fewer people paying into the system and more people who are receiving benefits from the system. We can see the reports and financial data And we can see the conclusions. And I always tell people this and say, hey, don't take my word for it. You know, you should take the word of the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. You know, the Treasury Secretary says Social Security is going bankrupt. And hey, it's not going to happen tomorrow. This isn't going to happen for another, you know, 10, 12 years. But that doesn't mean it's not important. It's hugely important. And that's the nice thing about it is because, you know, these trends, they generally tend to be very long-term trends, which means that, you know, there are sensible things that you could sort of do, you know, steps that you can take now to make sure that, you know, over the long term, you don't become a, you know, an unfortunate victim or innocent bystander to these huge trends that are unfolding and actually be proactive. This is what we were talking about earlier. We have the ability as human beings to make choices about what we do with our time and our lives and our whatever it is, our money, our assets, our brain power, our muscle power, all these things. We can choose what to do, and we can either choose to accept and acknowledge that there are some, you know, very big trends that are unfolding and say, well, I should probably do something about this. And there are a lot of things that you can do about it. Or you can say, man, I'm just going to stick my head in the sand and keep swiping on Instagram and whatever else. You know, people kind of they tend to waste a ton of time and just not do anything at all and just assume that it's probably going to work out fine. Or don't think about it at all. You know, that's sort of that's a very dangerous thing to do. And again, going back to history, history generally tends to be quite kind to people that see the writing on the wall and do something about it, even they might be early, as opposed to people that just do absolutely nothing and end up getting slaughtered by these, you know, giant historical trends that inevitably unfold.
I think that's a pretty good place to end it for today. Thanks for joining me, Simon. And thanks to everybody out there listening. And we'll make sure we get another podcast out there soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Enjoyed it.